Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the second of a series of roundtable discussions. You might call this the second act of a three-act circus, where at the end of each symposium, a group essentially summarizes what each of the members of the group consider to be the important contributions that have been made to lunar science. And in fact, that's the way I think we might start off. Each of us here have different backgrounds, and it might be interesting to see what each of us considers to be the important contributions and their significance, the important contributions that we've learned about yesterday and today. First, let me begin by introducing the members of the panel. My name is Frank Press from MIT. To my left, in order, John Wood of the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory, Paul Gast of Columbia University, Jack Schmidt, scientist, astronaut, and Johannes Geis from University of Bern in Switzerland. I'll use the chairman's prerogative and start myself with a brief summary of what I think I've learned that is of unusual significance. Throughout the discussions of the past 2 days, I've, as many of you, have been contrasting what we've learned about the moon with what we know about the Earth. And the differences are truly amazing, and to me, many of them are unanticipated. The Earth's surface, 90% of the Earth's surface, is composed of rock that is probably younger than 150 million years or 200 million years. The situation on the moon is quite different. A major portion of the moon may be older than billions of years. If you were to remove the oceans and view the Earth as a whole, you would see a certain regularity to the tectonic grain, to the pattern of the Earth. Not only the famous jigsaw puzzle fit of the continents, but the major world-circling rift, which has become famous in our field as the source of new crustal material. Such features are completely absent on the moon. There is no such pattern. And this, of course, is also connected with what we've learned this afternoon about the relatively low level of seismic activity on the moon. On the Earth, the seismic activity is connected with this regular pattern of the distribution of continents, essentially of plates, of the rigid plates which make up the outer layers of the Earth. There is no corresponding feature visible to us on the moon. The seismic waves and their remarkable duration following the impact of the LEM indicate an unusual perfection in elasticity. And this in turn implies, among other things, perhaps very cold outer rocks of the moon. If you couple this together with what we know about the mascons and the fact that the compensation for the mascons must be very deep compared to the depth of isostatic compensation on the Earth, if there is compensation on the moon, it implies, together with the seismic data, that the lithosphere on the moon is much deeper than, that is, the strong, rigid outer layer of the moon, is much deeper than the corresponding layer on the Earth, where it may be some 70 kilometers thick. On the moon, it might be many-fold thicker than this amount. It is impressive to me that the surface density of the moon, at least in the mare that have been visited, the intrinsic density of the surface rocks being between 3.2 and 3.4, surprisingly close, perhaps even embarrassingly close to the mean density of the moon. That this is in marked contrast to the crustal rocks of the Earth, even the crustal rocks on the seafloor, whose density is below 3. The absence of evidence, any evidence for water, hydrothermal alteration, metamorphism, in water alteration in lunar rocks, the absence of this evidence indicating the absence of water in the outer layers of the moon is another important fact to my mind, because in recent years the importance of water is only being appreciated in controlling many phenomena on the Earth, in lowering the melting point of rocks in the outer layers of the Earth, perhaps producing the low velocity zone, which is the depth of compensation, the zone of weakness beneath the strong lithosphere. The moon is in marked contrast to the Earth in this respect. It doesn't have water to produce this important dynamic weakening below the lithosphere. These, to me, are the important facts. They have certain implications for me. I'll come back to these later if there is time. I go now to Dr. Wood.
Thank you. My group at the Smithsonian works in mineralogy and petrology. I think there are about 30 or 40 groups here at this meeting who've worked in this field, and I suppose the first thing that's impressed me about the meeting is the high quality, the overall high quality of the work that I've heard reported, and the fact that people don't seem to be contradicting each other. The story comes out so nearly the same in each case that I suppose I would have to say you get a little tired of listening to it the 30th time. The sample, of course, was taken in Mare Tranquillitatis, but the Tranquility base was only about 50 kilometers from the edge of the highlands. From theoretical considerations and cratering studies, we knew very well that a certain amount of highlands material had leaked into the Mare there, and that the sample collected would contain a component of highlands material, however small. And, of course, we were interested in trying to identify this component if possible. We found in the sample that about 4% of the particulate matter consisted of a light color, low-density rock, which is essentially an anorthosite. Now, for people without geologic bent, anorthosites are a type of rock that occur very rarely on the Earth and are very poorly understood. The principal occurrence of anorthosites is actually in the Adirondack Mountains. Anyway, we found these little particles, and I came to the meeting to assert that we thought that these were pieces of the lunar highlands, that we had already sampled the highlands without going there. And I expected to have imprecations screamed at me and chairs and slide projectors thrown. And I get here and find that everybody else has found the same thing and come to the same conclusion. And in this particular group of people, a unanimity of opinion like this is a very rare thing to be cherished. Now, taking this as a point of departure, that apparently the highlands are made of anorthosites, a very peculiar rock type, it is possible to suggest crustal models of the moon, which are extremely interesting. If you consider that the highlands are high by virtue of the fact that they are low in density like these anorthosites are, and that they're floating on something heavier, you come up with a vague picture of a crust perhaps made entirely of anorthosite, which is some 20 kilometers or so thick. And one can go in many different interesting directions from this idea in terms of the structure, the chemical and thermal evolution of the moon. I'm sure I've already said too much, so I'll stop at this point.
I'd like to take a slightly different tack rather than just summarizing what has been said and say that one of the things that seems to be the cause of a lot of puzzlement in talking to people around here is that some of the questions that are being asked of the moon are not being defined rather very explicitly. Some people are assuming what other people are trying to prove. This often causes confusion on the part of some of the listeners. I think if we I outline sort of areas that I'd like to cover rather briefly. First is the ages that were reported, which Dr. Press has already alluded to, and something about the composition of the rocks and local processes that have been taking place at Tranquility Base or in that general vicinity. And thirdly, mention something about the composition of the moon as a whole. If we look at the results or summarize the results that have been reported on the ages, I think one thing is quite clear, that we have established the time of crystallization of an igneous rock, which everybody agrees is an igneous rock, and that this time of crystallization is very close also to the time of formation of this liquid. If this is a very widespread rock, then we've dated the time of a major event in lunar history, and this happened around 3.7 billion years ago. When you go beyond that, things get a little bit more confused. The ages that have been reported for the soil of 4.6 are rather interesting, but when one steps back and asks, what do you mean by the age of the soil, you start realizing right away that this isn't a simply defined event like the age of crystallization of an igneous rock. And I won't pretend or try here to unravel the whole thing. It's what you mean by the age of the soil is intimately involved with your model of the origin of the soil. If the soil is an average material of a very large area on the surface of the moon, then you would expect that it simply integrates over this area and produces an average of all the chemical differentiation processes that may have gone on in the lunar surface. If, for example, you took glacial till, which was a well-mixed sample of the whole Canadian Shield, you would not find out from that glacial till that there were rocks of different ages in the Canadian Shield. You'd get some sort of an average of the whole shield. So I think one should be cautious in interpreting the meaning of the very old ages that have been reported for the soil. There's no question about their validity. It's a question of interpretation. With respect to the composition of the rocks, the igneous rocks in particular, as in the case of the petrography, it's very clear that most everybody observed exactly the same thing. There are certain major features which seem to point very strongly toward an igneous differentiation process. That is, we are looking at a liquid which is the residual residue of perhaps a much larger original volume of liquid, perhaps as little as one-fourth of the starting material. The question now becomes, where did this differentiation take place? Did it take place locally at a very shallow depth, like maybe within a kilometer or a few kilometers of the surface in the region of the Tranquility Base? Or was this differentiation which we see in these rocks a result of a very deep-seated process, perhaps hundreds of kilometers in the lunar interior? I think this question needs to be asked explicitly. Different people have different opinions on it, and answered before we can go much further. The next question about these liquids then becomes, and this question depends very much on what your answer to the previous one is, where was the liquid formed? Was the liquid formed at great depth in the interior, or was the liquid formed very near the surface, perhaps by heating of the surface by impact? I think that is one example where implicitly certain investigators have almost assumed the answer to the question and gone on from there. I think if one person makes one assumption and another one tries to answer it, we're certainly going to get in a certain amount of confusion. I'd like to highlight that as a problem that I feel needs to be answered. And finally, with respect to the whole moon as a body, I think the chemistry that we have heard has repeatedly shown that there is a extensive depletion in certain volatile materials. Water is certainly one of these, but the far less volatile materials than water seem to be very depleted in both the soil and in the igneous rocks, and it turns out also in materials from the Apollo 12 site. What is the cause of this depletion is a very important question. Does the whole moon have this characteristic is an important question. Some people have proposed that the moon as a body was so hot that these materials were essentially vaporized away from the moon. This has certain implications which I think ought to be looked at rather carefully. I mean, there should then be some fractionation of these elements with respect to their atomic mass. There is an alternate possibility that this was a primitive feature of the moon and was in fact a characteristic of the material that went to form the moon, and that it dates back even further than the formation of the moon. I think this particular area of investigation will have very important implications with regard to theories of the origin of the moon itself and its formation from more dispersed matter in the solar system.
Well, I think I'll take a little different tack also. You asked what initially we started here with, what have we learned so far and how does that affect how we feel about the moon. I think my one disappointment so far in some truly amazing revelations is that nobody's found an eclogite, but I still have hopes. I'm going to speak first of all as a field geologist, which I think is most important to me right now. And as that, I think we should start looking at the sites that are selected for our next few missions, not just for the particular problems for which they were selected, but for those problems that have been brought to light by Apollo 11 that are general problems to the whole moon, which is mainly what we are able to talk about from the Apollo 11 samples. For example, I think now we can be specific about some of the general things we as field geologists had said ought to be done. We need to examine the bedrock very, very closely. The bedrock, of course, is exposed to us in some of the larger craters, and it's also exposed almost certainly in an inverted form around the blocky rim craters on the rims, which are somewhat more accessible. In this, we want to look closely at the layering for our evidences of the local differentiation that Paul has just talked about, for flow-to-flow differentiation that may imply, may make us come to conclusions different than what he has spoken of, or possibly the same. We need to look in this true bedrock for the xenoliths, that is the odd fragments, which will tell us more about the parent rock of this material, if there is a parent rock, about the cumulates or separates, depending on how you define them. We need to look at the veins and the vugs and the inclusions. In the bedrock, again, the late differentiates are becoming more and more important as people talk about the findings of the lack of water, the presence of carbon, the halogens, and this sort of thing. The soil, the regolith horizons that may be within the bedrock itself are going to be extremely important, I think, for learning the flow extrusion rate if we are dealing with multiple flows. Also, I think there's going to be a lot of evidence on the question of the viscosity, which we all feel probably, I think some of us feel is quite low, but I think we have a lot farther to go on this. Now then, from the bedrocks, we look at the soils, which are by far the most abundant thing to look at on the moon, and I think Apollo 12 has indicated that we're going to get more and more information out of these soils, and information pertinent to the problems we're discussing here this week. The chemical and age variations among the soils, taking also into account Paul's discussion of what the age of a soil may mean or should mean. This can be a function of terrain. We also want to look at the solar wind variations, which I think we'll hear a little more about. This, it will show up in the soil stratigraphy that is becoming apparent in the Apollo 12 samples, and certainly can be sampled much more rigorously than we've done so far. I think the accumulation rate of soils was brought to light in the very first talk you heard here this week. That, too, will be locked up in some way in the stratigraphy by interrelating the ages of the soils and their relative positions. There may be in these soils, if we really start looking closely at them, indication of directionality. Each new layer of soil, if in fact that's what we are seeing in the Apollo 12 samples, should have come from a different direction. Whether or not we can see this clearly or not is an open question this time, but I think we ought to be thinking among ourselves, what are the clues that we could expect to see? surface lineations in these soils and patterns that are a function of the local terrain and bedrock and how these relate to the regional geologies are going to become more and more important to us, I think, particularly as we think about what the seismic data and other kinds of geophysical data are trying to tell us. Now, fragments. Again, we have many, many fragments to look out, probably at more commonly fragments than bedrock. We've listened today about various ideas in the so-called ZAP craters, whether or not we're dealing with ZAP storms or a continuous rain of ZAPs. The orientation and the relative orientation and burial of rocks that we sample and photograph can, I think, probably answer this question if, again, we correlate them with the other kinds of data that's important, particularly age data of the fragments and of the soils. The fillets, as we call them in the group that's worked with the field geology side of this thing, the fillets on the rocks, that's the little ramps around the edges of the rocks. These, again, I think we're going to have to look at very closely. I think they have a story to tell us that we haven't even started to look at, particularly with respect to the erosion of the rocks themselves. The mixing of fragments, as we see different kinds of them in the soils, above contacts, whether these be regional contacts that we know about from the photogeologic mapping or contacts that are determined on the spot after we get there. This, I think, can give us a lot more information about the development of the regolith and of the distribution of fragments with time above and in that regolith. The small scale or the detailed layering, lineations, foliations that I think we all feel are probably present within these flows. We've seen hints of them, I think, in some of the photographs that have been shown and some of the statements that have been made, but we really haven't gotten into that one yet. There's a world of information yet left to us on the structural environment of the flows, both during and post-extrusion, and of the detailed crystallization history of these fragments. Glass splatter, again, will become more and more important to us, and I think there's a directionality story and a distribution story that we haven't heard yet. I guess the final thing I would like to make, statement I'd like to make, is off that subject a little bit, and I think it's just to remind you that we have a lot of information on the regional geology of these sites. John made a very, I'll have to second everything he said about the fact that Lunar Highlands are not very far away. Let's keep that in mind. Whenever we deal with any particular subject that we talk about, no matter which meeting we're in, when you start working with the Apollo 12 samples, for example, keep in mind that there's a Copernican ray going right over the top of those of that area, and that's going to have a bearing on everything you say about your fragments and your samples.
Go on. Thank you. First of all, I would like to reflect something John Wood has said a little while ago. I also was very much impressed in my field, which deals with more physical aspects of the story. Isotope measurements, ages, and cosmic ray effects, solar wind, and so on. And I was very much impressed that all the different groups who have worked quite independently in different continents even have come here with very consistent results, even if the technical approaches were rather different. So this means that as far as the first order interpretation of the data goes, there's no great difficulty, and we have made great progress. Of course, if you come to the what I would call the second-order interpretation of data, there we would have just to have a little more time to think about this, and probably also need some more data. From my more personal point of view of interest, I think what is very important is that the Apollo 11 mission has added to the principal sources we have of solar system material, which was the Earth and the meteorites of rather unknown and questionable origin, have added two more sources. One is lunar material and the other is solar material, because there's so much solar material embedded in the lunar surface. Now, this is very important to geochemists, but also to people who are interested in isotopic ratios, like myself, and many here among the principal investigators and their associates. And there are many things which have already come out of the comparison of material from the sun, the earth, and the meteorites. I think rather surprising to many people was not only the very old rock ages, would have been rather surprising only half a year ago to many people, even present here, but also the very old exposure ages of the surface. We are seeing that the rocks, as well as the fine material on the lunar surface, has been exposed to the cosmic radiation that is it has been present close to the surface in about a range of a meter of the surface for half a billion years. And I think that is much older than many people have been thinking. Now, this is not only interesting in itself, but it affords us the possibility to use the lunar surface as a radiation monitor going back these many hundred million years. And there are several types of radiations one can study at this surface. One is the normal, the principal galactic cosmic radiation. The second one might class are the solar flare particles, which are somewhat lower in energy and less penetrating than cosmic radiation. Cosmic radiation penetrating typically half a meter, solar flare particles typically penetrating perhaps a centimeter or less. And finally, there's of course a solar wind, which penetrates only thousands of a millimeter or less. Now, since these surfaces seem to be so old, we have hoped to be able to understand and disentangle the record of these radiations on the surface, reaching back half a billion years, maybe longer. And in these first two days, a number of papers have been presented, which are a beginning here. One is the fact that we have 500 million years of cosmic ray exposure. There are several ways of studying cosmic rays, solar flare particles, and solar wind in the past. You can do it looking at radioactive isotopes. There are several groups which have done this, getting quite consistent results. You can look at stable isotopes, which is then an integrating method, or you can look at solid-state transformations, and the method most used there are the nuclear tracks. And all these methods give you some different information, which is beginning to come up here. One thing became clear during these first few days, that the solar wind trapping on the lunar surface is a rather complicated thing. We all expected that you would have diffusion losses of solar wind particles. Things like helium diffuse out of minerals, and in particular silicates, rather easily. But the story seems to be even more complicated. There has been so much solar wind bombardment on these surface grains. Individual grains may have been bombarded for 1,000 years or longer, that you get saturation effects. In other words, you push as many particles in as you are getting out. And this, of course, complicates this story. Also, there may be recycling effects of the sort that solar wind particles are coming out, forming a very tenuous atmosphere around the moon, and then are pushed back again into the lunar surface. From these examples, I think, everybody will realize that to understand the radiation history of the lunar surface is a very complicated process, and we are very lucky that we have something to continue on. In order to do this, I think in the future, sampling of cores will be very important. Sampling of young craters in old surfaces will be very important, and generally speaking, one can hope that there is a very strong feedback of the results we are having here and of the experimenters to the planners of the next missions, and I'm sure this will be possible to do, because for the sampling for understanding the radiation effect on the moon, a very meticulous sampling is necessary. Thank you.
We started late, so we'll continue for a few more minutes. Let me lead off now on a slightly different tack and perhaps open the response to both the panel members and also members of the audience. The main thrust of the meetings these past 2 days has been, what have we learned about the moon? A major justification in going to the moon is to know more about the Earth, to get more insight about why the Earth is as it is. And I'd like to ask, what have we learned about the Earth now that we've gone to the moon? Perhaps I'll stick my neck out. I think that the Earth, both bodies are of comparable age, and yet they followed a different evolutionary path. I think I would guess that the Earth is in an advanced stage of evolution, a highly differentiated planetary body, a body which is dynamically very active, and in that process is bringing its radioactive fuels, which is driving the whole thing, toward the outer layers, where these fuels are the least efficient, and perhaps we're seeing the Earth in a very late stage of evolution, just before it, in a sense, dies down. The moon, on the other hand, I might guess, has not evolved very far. It may not get any further than it has so far, as far as it's gone already. We're looking at a body, perhaps a body which is similar to the way the Earth was in the first billion years before the iron melting episode. Why these differences? Are these differences due to the different mass of the two planets, to the differences in the initial temperature, in the initial adiabatic heating, to differences in the initial chemical composition? I've raised a lot of questions here, more than perhaps I should have in the few minutes that we have left. Perhaps somebody either sitting at the table here or in the audience would like to make some general comments about what they've learned in the past few days contributes to this class of questions. Yes, Gustav. Would you say your name for the reporters?
Arrhenius, University of California. Professor Press pointed at one danger that is inherent in having panels like yesterday's and today's before the entire case has been judged. What strikes me is that the number of papers have appeared today, and I know of several ones tomorrow, that take up particularly the question of the occurrence of water. It's quite clear that there is no major amounts of water in the present crust we observe, but the small signs of the amounts that may be there or may be in more distant quarries are exceedingly important. There are several facts that point at sources of water. One is actual measurements of water by people like Sam Epstein that will report tomorrow. Others, the occurrence of hematite. The report of mica from one of the British groups and our finding, for example, of 2 phyllosilicates. The latter ones that I can speak more about are, which I won't do now, can be ascribed to hydroxylation of the surface by solar protons, but this is not the case with the other 4 or 5 different indications of some minor or distant source of water, so that the effect that Professor Press mentioned of the absence of water that lowers the strength of the interior might not be as important as suggested, but rather the low temperature of the interior of the moon, perhaps, as compared to the Earth. Thank
you. Frank, I might say a couple of things, not in answer to that, but again, we all relate to our own experience, and I guess the two areas that I'm most interested in as far as relating to your question of the moon to the Earth, one would be early affinities with economic geology, and that is, what are we going to learn, for example, about geochemical provinces by understanding the moon? And I think if we add the Apollo 12 preliminary data we heard yesterday to what we know from the Apollo 11 site, we can see now that we're going to have a geochemical variety on the moon, and that the potential for understanding some of these major problems of Earth geochemical structure, if I may use the term, is increasing rather than decreasing. And I think that we ought to keep that in mind as something that will pay off at least to our grandchildren, if not a little bit sooner. The other area of experience of mine is in trying to understand what happens in the mantle or at the crust-mantle interface. And my intuitive feeling is, although the issue is far from closed, in fact, I'm not sure which side has the most points right now, but that we are seeing information in what's happening with the melting relationships of rocks on the moon are going to relate to that problem in spite of the great difference in pressure. I think in some of the geochemical trends and this sort of thing, we may well learn a lot about relationships within our own mantle.
I think on the last point, the question of whether or not the Earth and the Moon may be of different compositions, there are several observations which certainly point in that direction. I mean, the very low lead content relative to uranium in the soil and the just generally low content of volatile elements, one way of interpreting it is that the Moon just has less of these materials in it than the Earth does. And this, I would think, would also apply to water. But I guess Professor Arrhenius says time will have to tell on that.
I ask about this problem of tracing the history of the sun back in time. I gathered, I wasn't too good on this question, but I gathered that you had some possibility of going back maybe 1 million years. Is there any possibility of seeing where the ice ages were the result of a decreased solar activity in the past?
I'm sure we cannot answer this question now yet, but there may be the possibility. You would have to resolve things on the time scale of 10,000 years, and if the ice ages and their rhythm is reflected by solar flare particles, then you should be able to see that. Now, of course, there are different ways to change the solar output. There's maybe very much reflected in energetic particles, then you would be able to see that. If it's in other parts of the radiation, then I wouldn't be sure.
I think, Johannes, maybe the point we were trying to make earlier about the stratigraphy of the soils is going to become more and more important in questions such as this, that if we get a detailed enough stratigraphy and if processes that form that stratigraphy operate rapidly enough or more frequently enough, then maybe we can start looking at those kind of questions, at least broader scale questions than that. But whether we get to 10,000 years is maybe a little questionable.
We should quit at 6:30, so we have time for one final word. Is there anybody who would like to have the final word?
Well,
we'll come back, Harold. We'll have two final words.
I'd like to dispute with the chairman a little bit about saying that the evidence to date indicates that the Earth and Moon are very dissimilar bodies at a very dissimilar stage in their evolution. I think that if one accepts the view that the Maria basins contain lava which has been derived from below, this indicates that a certain amount of differentiation has gone on. It was pointed out yesterday that there is a possibility of a small iron core in the Moon, and possibly the magnetic results tomorrow may also slightly point in that direction. And referring to what was said yesterday about the analogy between the gravitational anomalies on the Moon and the Earth, I think one must be quite clear that solid-state physics, as well as geology, point to the fact that the mechanical properties of the Earth and other planetary bodies depend very critically on temperature, probably on other things as well, but particularly critically on temperature. And this is the reason that a good model of the Earth is a rigid crust, and then underneath a flowing mantle where things can be churned up and differentiation proceeds and convection and so forth. And I think I would rather like to put the opposite point of view to you, Frank, and say that it just is a rather curious accident that the Earth has all these interesting things going on, like continental drift and mountain building and so on. It just happens
that the Earth's crust, for reasons which one doesn't need to go into now, is just below the critical size at which the convection can break the Earth's crust, cause mountain building and continental drift and earthquakes and so on. And one rather calculates that the moon's crust is probably just two or three times as thick as the Earth's, and this is what causes a very different behavior. And a factor of two or three in geophysics is nothing, of course.
Harold Urey, we'll have to let you.
I would like to agree very much with Paul Gast. I would like to suggest that we consider the study of the moon selenology and not geology. It is a different planet. And the laws and the things that have developed it are bound to be different. I am sure that you would not walk out of this building and call the landscape selenology. It isn't that at all. It isn't like it, whatever. And I think that this has resulted in a very narrow point of view in regard to the development of the moon by a large number of people. And I would just like to suggest that what Paul Gast says is the most important thing, that we realize we're working with a distinctly different object, and I'd like to suggest that it be called selenology.
They cut me off. Let's see, the panel will now still stand together for a press conference, is that right? And the audience can stay or not as they see fit.
Obviously they don't.
You rehearsed it. You rehearsed it. I've got to apologize to Britt Singer. I didn't call on him.
Okay, why don't we ask those members of the press that are in the room at this time to move forward, please. And let's gather in a group on this side of the room as much as possible.
When is the bank supposed to start? I never looked at my ticket.
I haven't even got my ticket. It's in my room.
It's going to be hard to talk to geologists after this.
In the world, I know.
Huh?
It's got to be a selenologist.
After Harold threw the long story solidly, you've got to step on one side or the other, right?
Let's all be sort of depressed with Harold, you know? He always, whenever the facts come out, it always turns out.
Well, all I said is, all I'm trying to say is, let's not always assume that things are the same.
I don't think anybody is.
No.